explosive device, a 15-megaton H-bomb on a remote South Pacific island. The radioactive fallout reached Japan and Australia, and also fell on a boat of Japanese fishermen, killing one, and rendering the others gravely ill. The blast set off serious criticism of U.S. policy around the world and in the House of Commons. The British leaders also vividly recalled Eisenhower's offhand remark in Bermuda the previous December that atomic weapons were now coming to be regarded as a proper part of conventional armament. They had heard Foster Dulles on March 29th indict Chinese actions like a prosecutor in a courtroom. They noted Ike's domino principle and his doom-filled prophecy should Indochina fall. They knew of Radford's planning for airstrikes against Viet Minh targets. Putting this evidence together, they had come to see American policy as reckless, driven by an obsessive anti-communism that might soon plunge the world into atomic war. Dulles therefore received a cool reception upon his arrival in London. On the evening of April 11th, after dinner at the American Embassy, he made his pitch to his British colleagues. He proposed the creation of a temporary coalition of 10 nations, led by the United States and Britain, that would guarantee Indochinese security, deter further Chinese aggression in Asia, and create a united bloc at the upcoming Geneva conference so there would be no precipitous French withdrawal, even if Dien Bien Phu should fall. Dulles wanted to demonstrate the resolve of free nations to halt the expansion of communism in Asia. The coalition would possess implied military power, but Eisenhower and Dulles hoped the forming of the coalition by itself would be a sufficient deterrent against future Chinese adventures. Eden smiled politely and said he would think about it. In fact, he had already decided to reject Dulles's proposal. Eden thought the scheme was provocative and dangerous. He preferred what he considered the least damaging solution, the partition of Vietnam into a communist North and a free South, an idea that was wholly poisonous to the Americans. Such a deal, Eden calculated, could be achieved at Geneva provided it was not undone by any injudicious military decisions imposed by the Americans. Threats and nuclear brinkmanship toward China were counterproductive. They could not be sufficiently potent to make China swallow so humiliating a rebuff as the abandonment of the Viet Minh without any face-saving concession in return. And if threats failed, then what? Nuclear war? Eden would have no truck with that. So, to Dulles's immense frustration, Eden rejected the United Action Plan for fear that it would lead to war, not avert it. Dulles and Eden met again just 2 weeks later, this time in Paris during a NATO conference. On the evening of April 23rd, as they gathered for an official dinner in the ornate and gilded splendor of the French Foreign Ministry on the Quai d'Orsay, Dulles learned that the French government had just received another anguished appeal from General Navarre, asking for American air intervention against the Viet Minh at Dien Bien Phu. Failing that, the surrounded French position could not last more than 3 days. Dulles and Radford, admitting that it was now too late to save those embattled French soldiers, nonetheless beseeched Eden to set aside his doubts and announce his support for the creation of a united Western coalition that would defend the rest of Indochina from Chinese aggression after Dien Bien Phu fell. Eden immediately flew back to England and went to see the Prime Minister at his weekend retreat, Chequers, where he and Churchill discussed and again rejected the American proposal. Churchill hit the nail on the head. A small-scale military intervention would be both ineffective and likely to trigger a wider war with China and the USSR, in short, the worst possible outcome. The partition of Vietnam now appeared a safer and more plausible solution. That could be done at Geneva without paying the heavy price of war. Once again, the British stymied Dulles's plans. These developments left Eisenhower deeply unhappy. He fumed about the foolishness of the French, who kept asking for U.S. military intervention, but refused to respond to repeated requests to grant immediate independence to the Indochinese states. He thought the decline of France as a serious power was tragic, and that the French government had virtually abdicated. And he seethed about the cautious British and their morbid obsession that any positive move on the part of the free world may bring upon us World War III, as he put it to Swede Hazlitt. But he did not waver from his basic policy. Unilateral intervention by the United States was out of the question. If the coalition idea did not inspire the Allies, the United States would not act alone. On that point, Eisenhower was unbending, as he made clear on April 29th, when the NSC met again to review the situation. The team heard a depressing report from Radford, who carefully spelled out the dismal predicament of the besieged French soldiers at Dien Bien Phu. When Radford had finished, Harold Stassen, the director of the Foreign Aid Program, spoke up. Stassen had a reputation as a politically ambitious maverick. It must have been embarrassing to all in the room when he burst out with an impassioned plea that the United States intervene unilaterally to save Vietnam from collapse. French and British weakness should not render the United States inactive and impotent, he declared. This was a slap in Eisenhower's face, drawing him into a pointed colloquy with Stassen. If the United States moved in to rescue the French, Ike stated, we would, in the eyes of many Asiatic peoples, merely replace French colonialism with American colonialism. Furthermore, unilateral American intervention would mean a general war with China and perhaps with the USSR. The only way to sustain America's moral position in the world was through collective action in the name of freedom. To intervene alone in Indochina amounted to an attempt to police the entire world. Showing his sensitivity to the politics of the matter, he asserted, we would soon lose all our significant support in the free world. We should be everywhere accused of imperialistic ambitions. Stassen, who obviously did not know when to quit, kept pleading. To do no more than we have done, he cried, would be tantamount to giving Britain a veto on U.S. action in Southeast Asia. Eisenhower was unmoved. Such criticisms of Eisenhower's actions or inactions were not confined to the cabinet. Hawks in the press, none more voluble than Joseph and Stuart Alsop, wondered why the Eisenhower team, once so bold in its anti-communism, had lost its nerve. The Dien Phu, they suggested, was like Yorktown. Its loss will surely be such a psychological blow that Indochina must eventually fall into communist hands. The normally friendly editorial page of the Washington Post questioned why France had been abandoned and why Eisenhower had allowed the erosion of our vital interests in Asia. Calls for action rang out on the Senate floor when on May 4th, Republican Majority Leader Noland urged Eisenhower to act. Noland proposed American military intervention to save Indochina, even if the British refused to join the effort. There should be no British veto of American policy, he argued, nor could he tolerate what he labeled an Asian Munich, a sellout of pro-Western nations in Asia in exchange for a fragile and short-term peace. And these comments came from friends of the administration. When the Democratic Party held its annual Jefferson Jackson dinner at Washington's Mayflower Hotel on May 6th, party leaders took off the gloves and hit Eisenhower mercilessly. President Truman lambasted Ike for insulting America's allies, and Lyndon Johnson, who until that moment had never publicly criticized the president's foreign policy, launched into a bitter attack. Having alienated both Britain and France, he said, America stood naked and alone in a hostile world. The failure of Dulles to close the deal on his United Action Program marked a stunning reversal of policy. What is American policy on Indochina? Johnson asked the assembled Democrats as they dined on roasted capon in the cavernous ballroom. It was nothing more than a dismal series of reversals and confusions. Worse, we have been caught bluffing by our enemies. Johnson's attack, which kicked off the 1954 congressional midterm campaign, ended with a cruel barb. This picture of our country needlessly weakened in the world today is so painful that we should turn our eyes from abroad and look homeward. The next day, as if on cue, the terrible news arrived. The Dien Bien Phu had fallen. Having suffered over 3,500 killed, the French garrison was reduced to about 9,000 wounded, emaciated and ill Frenchmen, who now entered captivity. Many of them would die there. The French Empire in Asia faced total collapse. The dreaded Indochinese domino that Ike had prophesied looked ready to fall. Yet the president had refused to act. 8. Although Eisenhower would eventually win the praise of posterity for staying out of the Indochinese War in 1954, at the time, most observers believed that he and the United States had suffered a terrible defeat. Critics said that Eisenhower had abandoned France, an old ally, as it was engaged in a death struggle with communist insurgents. The president looked on as Dien Bien Phu and northern Vietnam fell to communist battalions. After much bluster about the domino theory, Eisenhower was compelled to reveal that he did not believe all of Indochina was worth fighting for. Most embarrassing, Ike and Foster Dulles could not even persuade Britain, the most stalwart of friends, to join a coalition to help defend Asia from communism. The Washington Post called America's failure on united action one of the most humiliating diplomatic defeats in its history. Secretary Dulles wearily rebutted the charges of failure. In a nationally televised address on May 7th, he explained that the president had resisted military intervention because the United States did not wish to be seen as propping up colonialism in Asia and did not want to act without Allied support. Yet he went on, curiously, to reemphasize the domino principle. If Indochina fell to the communists, the rest of Asia would rapidly follow. The tensions in the policy were obvious. The sky was falling, Dulles said, but America would not act to hold it in place. Dulles publicly tried to rationalize his administration's policy, but on May 12th, while testifying in executive session before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he seemed genuinely flummoxed and unsure of himself. America had done everything it could short of war. It tried to press the French to decolonize more rapidly, helped train Vietnamese troops, gave France huge sums of money and military hardware, and sought to build an Asian NATO to rally morale. None of it had worked. His plan for united action was now in the doldrums, he confessed. American policy has, at the present moment, fallen into a state which I would not like to call exactly collapse, but a state of suspended animation. Asked to explain why the French had been so badly beaten at Dien Bien Phu, despite having chosen that ground to defend, Dulles blamed poor French intelligence, a greater quantity of Chinese military materiel than was expected, and, inevitably, the devious behavior of the Oriental. Almost always, it seems our Western people underestimate the capacity of the Asian troops to move surreptitiously through the jungles at night, through trails that are impassable to white people. The senators nodded in assent. The Eisenhower administration had no plan for what to do next. The world's attention turned to Geneva, where delegations from the great powers had been meeting to discuss Korea and, after May 8th, Indochina. The United States, not a combatant in Indochina, did not officially participate in those discussions. French Foreign Minister Bidault, in obvious anguish, was compelled to call for a ceasefire following the fall of Dien Bien Phu. The Viet Minh representatives working under the close supervision of the Chinese might well have scoffed at such a proposal. They were winning the war, after all. But unbeknownst to the Western powers, China and, behind the scenes, the USSR, wanted the Indochina conflict to come to an end, perhaps a temporary end, but an end nonetheless. They saw how much the Viet Minh had gained and wanted to forestall an American military intervention. Widening the war, seizing the rest of Vietnam, and planting the red flag across all of Indochina, that would surely tip American opinion toward the war. So the communist side floated the idea of a temporary partition of Vietnam in order to separate the warring parties and implement a political process for a post-colonial Vietnam. The French hesitated. Bidault, an arch-imperialist who hated to give up Indochina, tried to quash talk of partition. He even engaged in secret and fruitless talks with the Americans about some kind of military operation in southern Vietnam. It would resurrect the defunct United Action scheme. Dulles was sympathetic, for he too opposed partition. It would look precisely like the Asian Munich that the GOP had decried. But the military option had been foreclosed by France's collapse in the North, and in any case, Eisenhower would not budge from the principle that any intervention had to be coordinated with America's allies. The Americans instead fell back on the barren idea of launching an all-out nuclear war on China if the Chinese now overtly intervened in Vietnam as the French were pulling out. In discussing this position with his senior advisors, Eisenhower revealed that his patience was running out. If the communists tried to snatch all of Indochina now, he said, the U.S. response would be massive. There should be no halfway measures or frittering around. The Navy and the Air Force should go in with full power, using new weapons, and strike at air bases and ports in mainland China. As Dulles put it to Smith, war with China waged primarily with sea and air power and modern weapons, by which he meant nuclear weapons, was infinitely to be preferred to the task of intervention in Indochina. Rather than wage an unending jungle conflict, the United States could simply launch a nuclear strike on China. This war talk illustrated the administration's frustration rather than a plausible policy. In any case, events on the ground in Vietnam made Chinese intervention quite unnecessary. After Dien Bien Phu, soldiers in the French-backed Vietnamese army deserted at an alarming rate. The confident and powerful Viet Minh redeployed its forces to threaten Hanoi and could, if it chose, snap up the rest of northern Vietnam without much trouble. Whether at the point of a gun or at the peace table, the Viet Minh was going to take northern Vietnam. Events in Paris, too, drove the action. On June 18th, the French National Assembly voted Pierre Mendès-France into office as prime minister. Publicly committed to ending the war and signing a peace agreement within 1 month, Mendès-France dismissed Bidault and set about making a deal that would temporarily cut Vietnam in half, impose a ceasefire, secure some Western influence in the southern portion of the country, and allow for nationwide elections in 1956. Once he had settled a crucial sticking point, the neutralization of Cambodia and Laos and the removal of all Viet Minh troops from those two states, Mendès-France moved rapidly to accept the partition of Vietnam. The Eisenhower administration, its policy in tatters, had little choice but to make the best of these distressing events. On June 23rd, Eisenhower and Foster Dulles met with congressional leaders in a private conference. Senator Noland inevitably frothed that the French were going to agree to a Far Eastern Munich and accused the administration of appeasement. Dulles had anticipated this and met Noland with a coolly reasoned and optimistic reply. The shift in the French position toward partition was not as black as it might appear on the surface, he said. If the French left Indochina altogether, a South Vietnam could emerge under U.S. tutelage. There is today the possibility of salvaging something free of the taint of French colonialism. With the French out of the way, the United States could establish a military line, and we must hold that line. It would cost much more money, perhaps $800 million a year, and commit the United States to defend the free states of Southeast Asia, but this was the path forward. We must hold the western side of the Pacific or it will become a communist lake, he concluded. Eisenhower agreed and summed up the new American position. In simple terms, we are establishing international outposts where people can develop their strengths to defend themselves. We cannot publicly call our allies outposts, but we are trying to get that result. The American era in South Vietnam had begun. Ike and Dulles had realized that the peace deal in Geneva rescued a confused and contradictory American policy in the region. Rather than working alongside a rotten French colonial administration to suppress a powerful communist nationalist insurgency in the North, the Eisenhower administration could write off the French experience as a terrible failure. In its place, the Americans would use their know-how to construct a new South Vietnam on the ashes of the French Empire. In this emerging state, America could showcase its way of life and its democratic ideals and declare its unalterable opposition to further communist encroachment. Although the United States was not a signatory to the Geneva Accords of July 21, 1954, which ended the war and divided Vietnam, the Eisenhower administration embraced them nonetheless. Secretary Dulles released a statement on July 23rd saying that, "While the Geneva Agreement contained many features which we do not like, the important thing was not to mourn the past, but to seize the future. With France and its heavy colonial baggage gone, America could begin its own kind of nation building in South Vietnam. One day this fledgling protectorate might come to look like West Germany or South Korea, other divided nations in which Western resolve had stabilized the dangerous frontier. South Vietnam would become a new test of America's purpose in the Cold War." In August 1954, Eisenhower signed off on a new statement of American policy in Asia. NSC 5429 asserted that, "In order to compensate for the loss of prestige the West had suffered due to the communist victory in northern Vietnam, the United States would rededicate itself to shoring up military and economic ties to Japan, Taiwan, and the Philippines, as well as Australia and New Zealand. Laos, Cambodia, and South Vietnam, too, would come under the American umbrella." A new regional security treaty, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, would pull Asian states into a military alliance backed by American power. Rather than being an outdated colonial structure designed to prop up European influence, CETO would serve as a joint enterprise of Asian states that desired American partnership to keep communism at bay. In discussing this new muscular policy in the NSC on August 12th, Dulles relished its simplicity. In the Southeast Asia Treaty, it was proposed to draw the line to include Laos, Cambodia, and South Vietnam on our side. The theory of the treaty was that if the communists breached the line, we would attack communist China. Eisenhower agreed. America had suffered a black eye in northern Vietnam, even if the defeat had been France's. Ike welcomed the opportunity to clarify American policy. From now on, with the colonial question out of the way, things would be different. The president wrapped up the NSC meeting with the simplest of statements. "Sometimes we must face up to it. We can't go on losing areas of the free world forever." 9. Within weeks, he would have his first chance to demonstrate America's newfound resolve, not in Vietnam, but in Taiwan, then called Formosa. Taiwan was the island redoubt of Chiang Kai-shek, the Chinese nationalist leader. Following his defeat by the communists in 1949, Chiang and his nationalist army had fled to Taiwan, where he became one of America's most important allies, much admired by hawks in Washington for his stout anti-communism, his Methodism, and his Wellesley-educated wife, Song Mei Ling. To communist China, however, Taiwan represented a strategic threat as well as a highly embarrassing piece of unfinished business. Mao Zedong desperately desired the destruction of Chiang's outpost, and in July 1954, he asked the Chinese military to draw up plans for an invasion to liberate Taiwan from foreign control. As a preliminary move, China had to seize a group of tiny islands right off its coastline that Chiang's nationalists had held since 1949, and that could hamper China's military operations. These island groups, collectively called Quemoy and Matsu, became the site of one of the most dangerous confrontations of the Cold War. On September 3, 1954, Mao gave the order to unleash a major artillery barrage on the island of Quemoy and its 50,000 nationalist troops. Analysts in Washington tried to divine Chinese intentions. Was this the start of an invasion of Quemoy and perhaps of Taiwan itself? Or was China simply testing America's resolve to back up the nationalists? Either way, the Chinese attack presented the administration with a serious problem. Eisenhower could signal indifference to the shelling, effectively abandoning the small offshore islands to the Red Chinese. But that would undermine Chiang, damage America's prestige in Asia, and cause a firestorm of protest by the Asia First Republicans at home. Or Eisenhower could declare America's unalterable support for the tiny islands and reply to Chinese attacks with a war on China. As Secretary Dulles put it in an NSC discussion, it was a horrible dilemma. The NSC debated this awful predicament in mid-September, and its members fell out much as they had over Indochina. Radford urged a swift response to the attacks and wanted to provide air and naval support for Quemoy, knowing full well this would mean war with China. Secretary of Defense Wilson said he was opposed to getting into war over these doggone little islands, and Treasury Secretary Humphrey agreed. Much as they had done in Indochina, Eisenhower and Dulles tried to find a way to delay, prevaricate, and keep the Chinese guessing. On September 12th, Dulles suggested to Wyck that sympathetic allies might raise the issue of Chinese aggression in the UN Security Council, thus perhaps embarrassing the communist bloc and buying time. While this ruse played out, the administration debated its next move. Although Eisenhower recognized that the islands were not really important except psychologically, they could not be given up under duress to the communist Chinese, especially in light of the recent American passivity in Indochina. Yet the islands also could not be defended tooth and nail. These were insignificant islets, little more than seaweed-choked clusters of rock that were not vital to America's security, and for that matter not vital to Taiwan's defense either. In short, they were nothing but symbols. Was America going to attack China with atomic bombs over a few small islands? The stakes were indeed that high. For as Eisenhower chillingly stated to the NSC, if we are to attack communist China, the president was firmly opposed to any holding back like we did in Korea. This time, the war would go nuclear. Eisenhower certainly did not want the conflict to escalate. His mailbag was filled with letters asking, as he put it, "What do we care what happens to those yellow people out there?" It would be a big job, he said, to explain why Americans should die for these tiny islands. But the black eye America had received in Vietnam was still bruised and tender. Eisenhower simply could not tolerate any more Chinese provocations. To find a middle course, Eisenhower and Dulles chose to offer the nationalist government a defensive security treaty that would commit the United States to the defense of Taiwan and the neighboring Pescadores Island group. Such an act would demonstrate resolve to domestic critics and reassure Chiang and other Asian allies that America meant to stand up for its friends. But the treaty would leave out any specific mention of Quemoy, Matsu, and other offshore islands. The purpose of this bit of guile was to gain credit for supporting Taiwan, while avoiding the burden of an explicit commitment to defend the disputed islands. Eisenhower was a master at delay and evasion, and this action personified his style. Don't make a firm decision until you absolutely must. At the start of December, the United States and Taiwan initialed a security pact, giving American guarantees to Taiwan, but making no mention of Quemoy and Matsu. But the crisis did not end there. This defense treaty, even with its hedging about Quemoy and Matsu, outraged Mao. He saw it as proof that the United States aimed to create a U.S. military colony in Taiwan. On January 6, 1955, Mao's forces opened up a new artillery barrage, this time on the Ta Chen Island group, located 300 miles north of Taiwan, and seemed poised for further military operations along the offshore islands. As his advisers huddled together in anxious meetings in Washington on January 19th and 20th, Eisenhower had to look the problem in the face. Had the time for a showdown with China arrived? Secretary Dulles advised Eisenhower to pressure the nationalist forces on Ta Chen Island to abandon their position, which was militarily not significant in the defense of Taiwan, and at the same time to make a public statement that clarified the ambiguous language of the Mutual Defense Treaty to make clear that the United States would defend Quemoy and Matsu against any communist attack. "We cannot play a fuzzy game any longer," Dulles concluded. "That game was played out. The Chinese were probing, testing. It was time to take a stand and then deliver on our commitments." Not only that, Dulles said, now was the time for the president to ask Congress for authority to commit the armed forces to the defense of Taiwan, and to secure a congressional resolution to that effect. In short, Ike should publicly prepare for war. In a memorable meeting of the National Security Council on January 20th, Robert Cutler argued that Dulles's proposal was likely to increase the risk of war. Eisenhower firmly disagreed. By making American policy crystal clear and laying down an absolute line, the United States would actually decrease the risk of war with Communist China. In a reversal of his usual policy of deception and ambiguity, Eisenhower now admitted that America's deliberate obfuscation in Asia, what he called its dangerous drift, had backfired. Wilson and Humphrey dissented, just as they had done in the debate over bombing Dien Bien Phu. It was foolish to fight a terrible war with Communist China simply in order to hold all these little islands, Wilson insisted. Defend Taiwan, yes, but forget about these little islands that were within hailing distance of the mainland. But unlike in the Indochina crisis, Eisenhower lost patience with the strategy of delay and deception. The offshore islands were not by themselves crucial to the defense of Taiwan, but abandoning these islands would crush the morale of the nationalist troops, who might one day be called on to repel a Chinese invasion. Worse, coming so soon after the Western defeat in Vietnam, it would shatter the reputation of the United States in those East Asian nations that America had pledged to defend, and the domestic politics of any abandonment of territory to the communists would be very troublesome. In a revealing comment at the end of a long and contentious meeting, Ike said, "There was hardly a word which the people of this country feared more than the term Munich." Thus, on January 24th, Eisenhower sent a message to Congress asking for authority to use armed forces to defend Taiwan, indeed to do more than that, to repel attacks on closely related localities that might be a preliminary to an attack on Taiwan. That could only mean Quemoy and Matsu. "Our purpose is peace," Eisenhower declared, but then insisted that he be given authority to wage war if the line he now drew was crossed. 4 days later, the Formosa Resolution passed the two houses of Congress with near unanimity. Unlike during the Dien Bien Phu crisis, Eisenhower had laid down a bold red line and signaled to his adversary that he and his nation would not retreat. The passage of the resolution opened a new phase in America's public posturing toward China. Over the course of the next 6 weeks, administration officials went to considerable lengths to signal to the Chinese their new resolve. On March 8th, in a nationally televised speech, Secretary Dulles stressed that America would use new and powerful weapons of precision to defend its interests in Asia, a clear reference to atomic bombs. In his press conference on March 16th, Eisenhower backed up Dulles, saying, "In any combat where these things, nuclear weapons, can be used on strictly military targets and for strictly military purposes, I see no reason why they shouldn't be used just exactly as you would use a bullet or anything else." In case the press missed the point, he repeated, "Yes, of course, they would be used." The next day, in a public speech in Chicago, Vice President Nixon reiterated the government's position that tactical nuclear weapons are now conventional and will be used against targets of any aggressive force. Was Eisenhower really considering a nuclear war against China? The evidence seems clear that he was. In contrast to his reluctance to send troops to fight in Vietnam, He seemed prepared to hit China with a devastating nuclear airstrike, not just because such a blow could be delivered quickly and without infantry divisions on the ground, but also because the Taiwan crisis provided a clear-cut case of Chinese aggression against a U.S. ally. The Dien Bien Phu battle had been a muddle with no easy choices. The Quemoy crisis looked much simpler. A Chinese attack would be met by war. The nuclear saber rattling had the desired effect. On April 23rd, the Chinese foreign minister, Zhou Enlai, announced that China wanted no war with the United States and stressed China's desire for friendship with the American people. The shelling of the islands fell off dramatically, and the crisis was dispelled. Eisenhower's threats seemed to have worked. But at what cost? America's use of nuclear brinkmanship made Eisenhower look tough and determined, but it deeply alarmed the European allies, who now feared more than ever that the United States might trigger a global nuclear war. Ike's menacing warnings may also have pushed China into a search for its own nuclear weapon as a counterweight to America's. Just 10 years later, in 1964, China would test its first nuclear bomb. In evaluating Eisenhower's handling of the twin Indochina and Taiwan crises of 1953 to 55, it is difficult to support the argument that he demonstrated commendable restraint. Certainly, he decided against a unilateral American intervention in Vietnam in the tumultuous spring of 1954, but the problem of confronting communism in Asia was larger than that. His ambition to contain Chinese influence and suppress communist rebellions in Asia led him to make a series of dramatically hawkish public statements that pledged American prestige in Asia, and from which neither he nor his successors could easily walk away. By resorting to nuclear brinkmanship and constantly speaking about falling dominoes, Eisenhower narrowed his options for dealing with future crises. At some point, America would have to make the terrible choice between living up to its promises or skulking away. Yet one can rightly ask, what was the alternative to Eisenhower's policy? War certainly was one. Another would have been a politically disastrous decision to turn away from Indochina altogether and leave it to its fate. In retrospect, that might look appealing, but presidents do not govern in retrospect. They must make decisions in real time. And Eisenhower tried his best to pursue his broader goal of containment while avoiding war. He himself acknowledged the amount of improvisation that went into his policymaking. Far from claiming that he followed a grand strategy in Asia, he admitted that America threaded its way with watchfulness and determination through narrow and dangerous waters between appeasement and global war. To a great degree, he managed to accomplish that balancing act. His successors, alas, did not. Chapter 9. Taking on Jim Crow. There must be no second-class citizens in this country. 1. His mother wanted an open casket funeral. She wanted the world to see what they had done to him. In the early morning of August 28, 1955, in a small Mississippi Delta cotton mill town along the Tallahatchie River called Money, Emmett Till, a 14-year-old African-American boy, was abducted from his great-uncle's home, driven to a nearby barn, brutally beaten, and then shot to death. His naked body, wrapped in barbed wire and tied to a heavy cotton gin fan, was dumped into the brown, slow-moving river, where it lay on the muddy bottom until, 3 days later, two boys out fishing discovered the mutilated and swollen corpse. Till was from Chicago, where he lived on the South Side with his mother, Mamie Till Bradley, who had been born in Mississippi but moved to Illinois as a baby with her parents in the early 1920s. Young Emmett had expressed an interest in visiting his extended relatives in the South, where he planned to stay with his mother's uncle, Mose Wright, a sharecropper. 3 days after arriving in Money, Till and his cousins went to buy candy at Bryant's Grocery. Something about Till, An extroverted city kid from up north gave offense to the 21-year-old white woman, Carolyn Bryant, who was working behind the counter. Perhaps he had been impolite or had looked at her wrong. Mrs. Bryant later claimed that Till made suggestive remarks and had whistled at her. Many years later, she recanted. The details did not matter much to Roy Bryant, who returned home on August 27th after working a long shift as a truck driver, hauling shrimp from New Orleans to Texas. The idea that a black boy, from the North no less, had leered at his wife in his own grocery store was too much for Bryant to bear. Given the sexual innuendo of the tale Carolyn related to her husband, Roy felt fully empowered to administer the kind of punishment that whites had been doling out to black people in the South for many generations. It did not take long for Bryant and his half-brother, J.W. Millam, to discover that the boy they believed had insulted Carolyn was staying at Moe's Wright's house. They drove there in Millam's pickup truck at 2 a.m. on August 28th, seized Till, and threw him into the truck. Over the course of the next few hours, Bryant and Millam took the boy to a number of locations, beating him savagely at every stop, until finally they shot him in the head and threw his weighted body into the river. After Till's disfigured body was recovered, it was shipped back to Chicago. At the Illinois Central train station, Mamie Till Bradley dropped to her knees in anguished prayer upon seeing the wrapped bundle containing her son's remains. "Oh God, my boy! My only boy!" she wailed, filling the hall with her wrenching cries. She decided that his death would not go unnoticed. The body was placed in an open casket at the Roberts Temple of the Church of God in Christ at 4021 South State Street. For the next 5 days, as word spread and the murder became a national story, tens of thousands of people filed past the bier, gazing at the horrific sight. "Mississippi lynches boy," screamed the front page of the Pittsburgh Courier. "Emmett Till funeral saddens city, nation," was the headline of the Chicago Defender above heartbreaking scenes of the funeral. Jet Magazine published close-up photos of the boy's bashed and swollen, contorted face. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, demanded that the Justice Department launch an investigation and put an end to a state of jungle fury in Mississippi. Mayor Richard Daley of Chicago sent a public telegram to President Eisenhower asking for swift justice for Till, as did Governor William Stratton of Illinois. In Mississippi, however, the reaction to Till's murder was muted. Governor Hugh White named a special prosecutor, and the two suspected murderers were indicted and put on trial in Tallahatchie County just a few weeks later. But the white authorities quickly closed ranks. The prosecution was lackluster. The two men admitted to seizing Till but claimed to have released him later. The defense asserted that the body retrieved from the river could not be identified and that Till might still be alive. Witnesses were intimidated. The sheriff of Tallahatchie County, Clarence Strider, announced his opinion that the whole thing looks like a deal made up by the NAACP. The trial lasted 5 days and attracted national press coverage, though black journalists reporting of the trial were segregated from whites in the courtroom. The jury was all white and all male, and on September 23rd, after an hour of deliberation, it returned a verdict. Millam and Bryant were acquitted. Why did the Emmett Till case become a nationwide controversy? After all, this was not the only murder of a black person in Mississippi in the summer of 1955. In May, Reverend George W. Lee, a local member of the Regional Council of Negro Leadership and an NAACP organizer, was shot to death in Belzoni while leading a voter registration drive. On August 13th, a 63-year-old farmer and World War I veteran named Lamar Smith, who was also active in a voter registration campaign, was shot and killed on the steps of the Brookhaven courthouse. There had been little national attention paid to these murders. By contrast, Till's youth and the particularly vicious details of the murder transformed his case into a national tragedy. And his Chicago roots meant that the Northern press and politicians took an immediate interest and helped the NAACP in its efforts to shine a powerful light on Mississippi. When Till's killers walked out of the courtroom free men, the national news media was there to record the scene. And when in early 1956, Bryant and Milam defiantly and publicly admitted killing the boy, the murder case became a symbol of the shame of white supremacy and a rallying cry of the struggle for black freedom that in the 1950s was gaining power across the nation. For all its self-congratulation as a time of peace and prosperity, the age of Eisenhower was also a time of racial turmoil and confrontation. Eisenhower found the civil rights crisis a deeply unsettling and troublesome issue, one he was ill-prepared to handle. Yet presidents always confront crises they do not foresee and often do not understand. It is then that history is best able to take the measure of the man. How would Eisenhower respond? 2. Eisenhower had little personal experience with or knowledge of black people. True, his valet, the man who dressed him every day for 27 years, Sergeant John Mooney, was black. But Eisenhower's entire career was spent in the segregated U.S. military. His army patrons, Fox Connor, Douglas MacArthur, and George Marshall, had Southern ties, as did most of the general officers he led in the Great Crusade in Europe, from George Patton, a graduate of Virginia Military Institute, to Leonard T. Giroux, a Virginian, J. Lawton Collins, born in New Orleans, Lucian Truscott, a Texan, and Courtney Hodges from Georgia. Beadle Smith grew up in Indianapolis, where public schools were segregated until 1948, and Omar Bradley hailed from Randolph County, Missouri, where slavery had been practiced until the end of the Civil War. Soon after he left the Army, while testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee on Universal Military Service, Eisenhower was invited to give his views on racial segregation in the military. His response was quite lengthy. The Army, he opined, is just one of the mirrors that holds up to our faces the United States of America. There is race prejudice in this country, and when you put in the same organization and make live together under the most intimate circumstances, men of different races, we sometimes have trouble. He spoke about the segregation that was in place when he first joined the Army 4 decades earlier, calling it extreme and unnecessary. But he suggested that amalgamation would cause problems. You always have some men that do not like to mingle freely between the races, and therefore if you have a dance for your soldiers, you have a problem. But I believe those things can be handled. More difficult, he went on, was the issue of promotion. Black men without the opportunities for education that whites might have had would always be at a disadvantage in a desegregated army, Ike said. A better practice was to keep black units intact, thus allowing them to develop a cadre of black officers. Eventually, Eisenhower hoped, the human race may finally grow up, and such concerns would disappear. But for now, if we attempt by passing a lot of laws to force someone to like someone else, we are just going to get into trouble. These comments reveal a man who believed that racial segregation in both the Army and the nation had an organic quality. It was unpleasant and probably wrong, but because of its history, it could not be eradicated quickly. Nor should federal policy be seen as the principal agent of change. Let sleeping dogs lie. That Eisenhower held such views is not surprising. He had lived in small-town Kansas or on Army bases all his life, and he knew nothing of the crisis of black life in modern America. He had seen Jim Crow in operation and given it little thought. He had grown up in a world that was dominated by whites and in which black people had no power or prominence. He knew very little about the aspirations of black Americans. He had no black friends, no black teachers, no black role models, and no black colleagues. His favorite place to unwind was Augusta National Golf Club, a bastion of white male privilege in the heart of the Old South. He simply had no inkling that the struggle for African-American civil rights was going to become perhaps the defining social problem of his era and of the next half century. Eisenhower was hardly alone among white Americans in failing to perceive the depth of black anger and the urgent need for action, although already in the mid-1940s some leaders had begun to press for change. Truman had taken important steps, setting up the President's Committee on Civil Rights in 1946. It produced a landmark report, To Secure These Rights, in October 1947, which outlined specific policy proposals to advance civil rights. In July 1948, Truman ordered the desegregation of the federal workforce and the armed services, a major accomplishment. He called for a federal anti-lynching law and a ban on the poll tax. He also wanted to create a permanent Fair Employment Practices Commission to ensure non-discrimination in hiring in industries that were working on government contracts. But Truman was stymied by his own Democratic Party, which was deeply cleft on the issue of race. Segregationist Southern Democrats held a stranglehold on the Senate. No civil rights legislation had a chance in that chamber. Many of Truman's civil rights policies were stillborn. During the 1952 presidential campaign, Eisenhower shied away from making strong statements in support of civil rights. In his first press conference as a candidate, held in Abilene on June 5, 1952, he declared his unalterable support of fairness and equality among all types of American citizens, but quickly hedged, I do not believe we can cure all the evils in men's hearts by law. An echo of his 1948 congressional testimony, I do repeat again and again my fear, he told the press in New York on June 7th, that in law itself, we do not find the answer always. In Detroit a week later, he again extolled equality as the basic conception of our whole government. But he insisted that he would never use a coercive law when we might aggravate instead of help to advance the program of pure equality of opportunity in this country. By September 1952, Eisenhower had broadened his message somewhat, stating that he would eagerly abolish segregation in the nation's capital and continued to expunge it from the armed services. In enforcing Jim Crow segregation in Washington, D.C., he said, We have the poorest possible example given to those of other lands of what this country is and what it means. But he would not impose new laws on the South. An ounce of leadership, he said in a speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, is worth a pound of law. In a major address on civil rights in Newark, New Jersey on October 17th, Eisenhower said his goal was to act in a spirit of goodwill toward states where segregation still persisted. He wished to enlist cooperation, not invite resistance. Framing his statement as a criticism of Truman's failures to get results, he insisted that what was needed to deal with the problem of race relations, to provide equal opportunities and to end racism, is leadership. Leading by example and exhortation rather than using federal law, that was Eisenhower's preferred method. On civil rights, it seemed, he planned to speak loudly and carry a small stick. 3. To his credit, Eisenhower followed through on his modest campaign promises on civil rights. In his first State of the Union address just 2 weeks after his inauguration, he drew the nation's attention to the question of racial injustice. We know that discrimination against minorities persists in America. Such discrimination confined to no one section of the nation is but the outward testimony to the persistence of distrust and of fear in the hearts of men. This fact makes all the more vital the fighting of these wrongs by each individual, in every station of life, in his every deed. He then announced a concrete action. I propose to use whatever authority exists in the office of the president to end segregation in the District of Columbia, including the federal government, and any segregation in the armed forces. Washington was a southern town in the 1950s, and segregation had been in place there for many decades. President Wilson had overseen the formal segregation of the federal workforce upon taking office in 1913, and in a city in which one-third of all jobs were in federal service, this denial of opportunity had a huge economic impact on black city residents. Cafes and restaurants, buses, movie houses, public housing, and schools were mostly segregated. No black person could stay overnight in a downtown hotel. Black citizens who rode trains from the north to the south had to switch to segregated cars in Washington. When Eisenhower came into office, a court case was already pending that challenged Jim Crow in the capital city. The plaintiffs argued that there were already laws in the books in Washington, dating from the Reconstruction era, which banned racial discrimination in restaurants. The laws had been passed by the local government in 1872 and 1873 and had long been ignored but never legally repealed. The case, District of Columbia versus John R. Thompson Company, made its way to the Supreme Court, where arguments were heard on April 30, 1953. Eisenhower and his Attorney General, Herbert Brownell, showing considerable creativity, seized the opportunity to join the case and filed an amicus curiae brief in support of the plaintiffs. Brownell, who held progressive views on race and civil rights, wanted the Justice Department to deliver on the president's pledge to end segregation in the Capitol. His brief certainly pleased Thurgood Marshall, the chief legal counsel for the NAACP, who publicly praised the Attorney General for his support. On June 8, 1953, the court unanimously found that the earlier statutes banning whites-only cafes were valid. At a stroke, the court opened up the Capitol's dining places to African-American patrons, with the overt support of the administration. Movie theaters followed suit. It was only a start. The Capitol's public schools were still segregated, but that issue was also being taken up in the courts. For the city's African-American residents, this was a major victory, and the administration would seek to take political credit for the court's decision. Equally impressive was the speed with which Eisenhower embraced the tricky issue of segregation in the military. Of course, Truman had started the process to desegregate the armed forces, but much remained to be done. Across the country in the early 1950s, Army and Navy bases were still segregated, including military housing, schools, cafeterias, drinking fountains, and workplaces. In mid-March 1953, Eisenhower was asked at a press conference by an African-American journalist, Alice A. Dunnigan, if he was aware that the Army continued to operate white-only schools, which seemed incompatible with his declared policy of eliminating segregation in areas of federal responsibility. The question caught Ike off guard. "I haven't heard it." "I will look it up," he replied. But he went on to say, "Wherever federal funds are expended for anything, I do not see how any American can justify, legally or logically or morally, a discrimination in the expenditure of those funds among our citizens." There was little ambiguity in this message. The next day, Secretary of the Army Robert Stevens produced a memo for the President's press secretary, James Hagerty, that confirmed Dunnigan's assertion. There were indeed segregated schools being operated on military installations in Virginia, Oklahoma, and Texas. These schools, however, were funded by the states and supervised by local school boards. The only way to integrate these schools, Stevens believed, was to have base commanders negotiate with local authorities, and if they proved unwilling to comply, the Department of the Army would have to build and run new integrated schools. "If this happened," wrote Stevens, "the administration would surely be attacked in Congress and the press for needlessly spending public funds." Eisenhower brushed aside this objection and directed the Army and Navy to conduct a survey of their installations and report on the progress toward desegregation of their facilities. In early June, however, Congressman Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., the charismatic Baptist clergyman from Harlem who had served in Congress since 1945 and gained a national reputation as an outspoken civil rights advocate, made an embarrassing allegation. Eisenhower's own staff was blocking the president's policies. "Your official family," Powell charged in an open letter to the president, has completely undermined your stated position on segregation. Officials in the Veterans Administration, the Navy, and the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare were countermanding desegregation orders. The hour has arrived for you to decisively assert your integrity, demanded